It's Philosophy Talk.
Mama died today. Or maybe yesterday. I'm not sure.
The Stranger.
The Plague.
The Fall.
The Myth of Sisyphus.
Albert Camus and the Absurdity of Life.
What if we're just a bunch of absurd people who are running around with no rhyme or reason?
Camus says life is absurd, so can it be worth living?
The first step for a mind overwhelmed by the absurdity of things is to realize that this feeling of strangeness is shared by all men, and that the entire human race suffers from a division between itself and the rest of the world.
Is your life just a rock you have to keep pushing up the same hill over and over again so it won't roll back over you?
Our guest is Robert Zaretsky, author of A Life Worth Living, Albert Camus and the Quest for Meaning.
Camus and the Absurd.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, where Ken is a young, vibrant professor of philosophy, and I'm a broken-down, emeritus professor of philosophy.
Oh, John. Today, we're thinking about the influence of the existentialist philosopher, so-called Albert Camus.
Camus tackled one of the most fundamental philosophical problems there is. What is the meaning of it all? What's the meaning of existence?
Well, John, that's a really deep question, but, you know, Camus gave an answer that's pretty darn depressing. He thought that life has no meaning. It could never have any meaning. Nothing we can do could give it meaning. The very search for meaning is absurd.
Well, he kind of had a point, don't you think?
No, I don't think, actually. What would be the point of living if you actually thought that life is absurd?
Spoken like Camus himself. He famously said there is only one serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. He decided against it, by the way. He was haunted by the question of whether suicide could be the only rational response to the absurdity of life.
Yeah, but suppose we reject the presupposition that life is absurd. Shouldn't we address that first, don't you think?
Sure, go ahead. Got any good ideas for what could give life meaning? I know you well enough, Ken, to think that you're not going to point to God or religion.
Well, not for me personally, but whatever floats your boat, wherever you can find meaning. If it's faith that gives you meaning, go ahead, that's fine with me.
Well, you're confusing genuine meaning with comforting illusions. There are plenty of those. At least that's what Camus would say, I think. If there's no God, he can no more provide meaning than Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy.
Yeah, but what if there is a God? Then can he provide meaning?
Well, you know, if God exists, then, you know, frankly, he's a pretty lousy, incompetent God. I mean, just look at all the pain and suffering in the world. If he does exist, he's either an imbecile or a psychopath. Well, maybe I'm overstating it, but at any rate, his existence could only make life even more absurd. I mean, what's this guy got in mind?
Look, let's not debate that. Let's set God aside for a second, however psychopathic he might be. But there are other possibilities. I mean, think of relationships with other people, family, friends, communities. We love other people. They love us back. We care for them. That's why we keep going. That's why we live. That's what gives our existence meaning.
Temporary respite at best. They're all going to die. They're going to die eventually. Can you know that? Nobody likes to think about it, but let's face it, every single person you know and love, every single person on Earth today is going to die, and a lot of them will suffer a lot along the way. How's that anything but absurd?
Man, you're in a sour mood today, John. Suppose I grant you, just for the sake of argument, mind you, that life is in fact absurd. I still don't see how that means that suicide is the answer. I mean, come on, consider Nietzsche. He thought life was meaningless too, but he thought we could give it meaning that it didn't otherwise have by embracing illusions. I mean, that's what artists do, he said. They know what their trick is to know how to make things beautiful when they're not at all beautiful in and of themselves.
Well, as Ogden Nash said, Nietzsche is peachy, but liquor is quicker. But those are all cowardly and dishonest ways out. The absurd hero, Camus' character, need take no refuge in the illusions of art or religion. He openly embraces the absurdity of the condition. He's Sisyphus. condemned for all eternity to push a boulder up the mountain, only to have it roll to the bottom again and again and again and again. The hero fully recognizes the futility of his task, but he willingly pushes it up each time it rolls down.
That's a solution? That's an answer to the problem of absurdity?
Well, at least it's an honest confrontation with the truth and a defiant refusal to let that grim truth destroy one's life. At the end of his myth of Sisyphus, Camus says that we have to imagine Sisyphus happy.
Happy? Happy, really? Maybe I just don't have enough imagination, but I actually can't see what keeps Sisyphus going in this story, let alone makes him happy.
Well, I guess we ought to know more about Camus, about this thinker and writer. You know, he's often regarded as one of the great existentialist philosophers, although he hated to be called an existentialist or a philosopher.
So, well, who was this guy? Who was the real Albert Camus? We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to learn more about the man behind works like The Stranger and The Myth of Sisyphus. She files this report.
In the early 1940s during World War II, France was occupied by the Nazis. German soldiers marched the streets of Paris. Train stations were being bombed. Cafe doors were shuttered. And Albert Camus was at a house party. Camus would head to a friend's house to drink, dance, and perform live theater with folks like Pablo Picasso, Jean-Paul Sartre, and Simone de Beauvoir.
Theater was one of the things that kept them going, you know, in the midst of occupied Paris.
That's Andy Martin, a Cambridge University professor and author of The Boxer and the Goalkeeper, Sartre versus Camus. He says theater was an outlet for artists and intellectuals during wartime.
It was one of those things that you could just about get away with that got past the Nazi censors, particularly if you made it fairly obscure and existentialist. And they didn't really know what it meant.
But Camus didn't just perform plays. He also ran a French resistance newspaper and was a well-known author. In 1942, he wrote The Stranger, his ode to absurdism, the belief that life has no inherent meaning. The book is about a French-Algerian man who kills an Arab man for no reason.
I realized that I destroyed the balance of the day, the perfect silence of this beach where I'd been happy. And I fired four more times at the lifeless body, and the bullets sank in without leaving a mark.
Camus was born and raised in Algeria. He lived alone with his illiterate mother, who cleaned houses to make ends meet. He was a star soccer player as a kid, until he got tuberculosis. After that, he focused solely on writing and working for a socialist newspaper. By 1943, Camus was living in Paris, estranged from his wife in Algeria because of the war. That's when he met Jean-Paul Sartre. They immediately hit it off and would spend hours at Café de Flore talking about politics, theater, and the ladies. Camus and Sartre were both kind of playboys. All was well until they both had their eye on the same girl, Wanda Kosakovich. Sartre dated her first and gave her a role in his play, The Fly.
Oh, where do you come from?
Algiers.
Oh, I'm from Paris. Have you left anyone down there?
Yes, my wife.
Then Sartre made the bad decision of asking Camus to direct a play that starred Wanda. Bad because even though Sartre was a playboy, he was short, frumpy, and kind of looked like an ogre.
Like something hanging on the outside of Notre Dame Cathedral, basically, whereas Camus was the Bogart of his generation among French philosophers, and, you know, Vogue magazine wanted to photograph him and so on. So he had very much the kind of, you know, Hollywood movie star looks.
Sartre had spent 3 years trying to seduce Wanda. Then Camus shows up and seals the deal in less than an hour.
You know, right in front of Sartre, she fell for Camus in a big way, and this did cause a certain amount of bitterness and resentment on Sartre's side.
Martin says war provided a common enemy for Camus and Sartre, but with the Nazis gone, all the two had left were a lot of opposing viewpoints. The final nail in their friendship coffin happened when Camus published a critique of totalitarianism, which Sartre took as a personal attack on his own Marxist beliefs. They never spoke again.
Although they fell out, they remained conscious of what the other one was doing all the time. And I think that's very often true of you know, relations of our own, that where you break up with someone, but you nevertheless frequently think, oh, well, what is that person doing or thinking right now?
Albert Camus died in a car crash in 1960, at the age of 46. And though they weren't on speaking terms, it was Jean-Paul Sartre who wrote Camus' obituary. He wrote, "Camus and I quarreled, but a quarrel doesn't matter. It's just another way of living together without losing sight of one another in the narrow little world that is allotted to us." Sartre never forgot about Camus. And half a century later, neither have we. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka. We learned a lot about Camus and about Sartre, too. I mean, Camus, gosh, he got a lot done. He dies at 46. When he was my age, he'd been dead almost 25 years. And, of course, Ken and I share the burden of being incredibly good-looking philosophers, and that makes it hard to focus on the meaningless of life sometimes. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're thinking about the French Algerian writer Albert Camus. We're joined now by Robert Zaretsky. He's a professor of history at the Honors College at the University of Houston. He's author of A Life Worth Living, Albert Camus and the Quest for Meaning. He's also author of the forthcoming Boswell's Enlightenment. Robert, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Ken. It's good to be here.
So Rob, as we learned from Shuka's report, there's plenty in Camus' life to make him interesting to anybody. But in your particular case, what got you interested in Camus?
Oh, it was something much more banal than his life, in fact, John. I found a copy of The Stranger in my brother's bedroom when I was a teenager, and I picked it up, less to read than to impress the girls with, and I would carry it around with me. And I didn't succeed in impressing the girls, but the book impressed me. I would read it and not quite grasp what it was that the story was relating. But I kept at it, not just when I found it in my brother's bedroom, but over the course of my life. I kept on returning to Camus, and I had the sense, when I first picked it up and opened the pages, that he was speaking to me, not at me, down to me, but that there was an urgency in his voice, something that, even to a 16-year-old, had something deeply human and deeply close, and I've never put him aside. As a graduate student and as a professor, I keep returning to Camus, not just for my teaching, but for trying to make sense of my own life.
Well, that's quite a story. I didn't come across Camus till I was in college. I mean, I did search my brother's bedroom, and I found a copy of Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer, but it had a much more temporary influence, I'm afraid.
So now, well, there were copies of Playboy in my brother's bedroom, yeah, too. But
you went straight for the Camus. Now, that's
exactly
impressive. We've talked a little bit about Camus' claim that there's something fundamentally absurd about existence. So before we end this first segment, just tell us exactly what does he mean by absurd?
Well, he means something quite particular. For Camus, the absurd is not something that exists in and of itself in the world. The absurd is the consequence of a world which is silent, which does not offer any response to the question posed by human beings, namely, what is the meaning of it all? Why are we here? And this desperate longing for clarity, for meaning posed by human beings is never answered by the world. And so that, the result is, for Camus, absurdity.
So it's not in the world itself. It's not in us alone. It's in us in the world. It's in the relationship between us and the world. Because we have these, that's what I hear you saying. I just want to clarify. Because we have these longings or desires or something that the world doesn't answer. Is that
precisely
right?
Right.
Well, we'll have to, you know, one of the questions I want to ask you in the next segment is whether there could be a world that answered to these longings, right? So is it just a contingent fact about the world, or is the world, like, necessarily the kind of thing that couldn't possibly answer to our longings? But we'll get to that question. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Albert Camus with Robert Zaretsky from the University of Houston.
Is there something absurd about our need to find meaning in the cold, meaningless world? Is the world truly silent to our quest? Or is there some way of finding meaning in existence?
The Quest for Meaning, A Meaningless Universe, and The Absurd, when Philosophy Talk continues. Tell me why
we may all be strangers in a strange land. I mean, indeed, America's getting positively weird. But setting that aside, we're discussing the thinker who wrote The Stranger, Albert Camus. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
Our guest is Robert Zaretsky. He's the author of Life, A Life Worth Living, Albert Camus and the Search for Meaning. Now, you can join Rob for a live chat on our online community of thinkers on Friday, March 6th at 12 noon Pacific. Be part of the online chat by going to philosophytalk.org.
So, Rob, I want to get to this deeper question of whether the world might be such that, you know, there wouldn't be any absurdity in it. But I want to know what Camus' arguments are first for thinking that life is truly absurd. What reasons did he give for thinking that?
Well, Kenny doesn't have arguments. He makes this very clear in his essays, both The Myth of Sisyphus and The Rebel. And in fact, that's the very meaning of the notion essay. He chose that genre deliberately. He was a great fan of Michel de Montaigne. And as the French word essay suggests, these were trials, a groping, a probing, but not a series of arguments. And so what he offers, rather than arguments, are illustrations, depictions, suggestions, to point to something that he believes is humankind's common experience.
So he thinks, for example, the myth of Sisyphus isn't so much an argument, that there isn't so much an argument that human life is in some way deeply like that, but just we're supposed to see, read the myth, understand the myth, and just take, that's what life is like. Is that the idea? I mean, how am I supposed to be moved to the thought, yes, life is absurd, if not by an argument in Camus?
The same way that a novelist or a poet would move you to come to that conclusion, or at least see the possibility of that reality. He was a great fan of the Greek tragic poets, Sophocles in particular, and Aeschylus, and they don't provide arguments for for humankind's lot. They present a picture, and Camus was much more comfortable with words and with images than with thoughts. And this is one of the things that he himself admitted distinguished his work from, say, Jean-Paul Sartre's. Sartre was not a very good storyteller, but he's a very good thinker, whereas Camus always insisted that he was a much better storyteller than a thinker.
So the myth of Sisyphus, I mean, it's very powerful, but sometimes in his writings, he doesn't talk about the myth of Sisyphus to get the point across. He talks about the daily grind of someone who has a 9-to-5 or a 8-to-6 job and so forth and so on. But there seems to be a big difference between them. I mean, Sisyphus pushes this thing all the way up the hill for no reason. Then it rolls back down. Now, suppose he was pushing it up the hill because it was full of food and he stopped every roll or two and gave a kid a treat. Or suppose every time it rolled back down, he got $100 bucks or whatever the currency is in hell to send to his wife. I mean, the myth of Sisyphus, Sisyphus is really quite unlike the guy who does a 9-to-5 or a 8-to-6 job in Paris to feed his children and make his wife happy.
My sense is that for Camus, they are fundamentally the same. It's not the fact that it's a huge boulder that Sisyphus is pushing up the slope of that mountain. It's the repetition of the act and the fact that he will be doing this act and nothing but this act for all of time. And the 9-to-5 job, of course, in Camus' case, it's not 9-to-5. There's a 2-hour break for lunch.
and sex probably somewhere.
My
later.
Point exactly.
But it's the sheer repetition of the task, a task that has no, forgive me for using the word, transcendental significance or meaning, that underscores the absurdity of it for Camus.
So look,
I should make just one more point that for Camus there are really two kinds of absurdity. There's what I guess we can call metaphysical absurdity, which is what we've been discussing, but there's also political absurdity. And the two are deeply entwined for Camus. But
what's political?
I'll
what's
stop the difference?
No, well, you made a distinction. So, and you teased us with that distinction. So, what's the political absurdity? What do you mean by
that? Well, the political absurdity is what we've just heard on the newscast. For example, those tens of thousands of people who are now marching in St. Petersburg and Moscow to protest the assassination of Boris Nemtsov. This, for Camus, is a classic case of rebellion. And what does the rebel do? He protests the outrage when a state insists on giving meaning to an act that is murderous, justifying murder, premeditated murder. And that would be, and the political absurdity for Camus is that here is a people, the Russians, who are being denied their dignity, their integrity, their freedom to speak, their freedom to think. And you reach a tipping point, a critical mass, where at a certain point, individuals say, I rebel. Therefore, we are. They suddenly find that they're not alone, but there they are in a square with tens of thousands of others.
So wait a minute, though. See, that I'm not quite sure I follow Camus or you, speaking in his voice. That thing within the rebel who says, I reject this thing that you throw on me. I reject this meaning that you try and impose on me. That shows something about, one might think in a Kantian mode, say that shows something about the absolute dignity of a human being that refuses to be oppressed, that is an autonomous end in itself and demands that it be regarded as an end in itself. Creatures that can regard themselves as ends in themselves, as Kant would put it, and can that demand of others that they regard them as ends, that's not meaningless. That's absurd. That's human dignity. That's absolute moral worth, inviolable moral worth. So I don't get how that has any... I mean, sure, you're trying to impose something on me, but the very voice in me that can say no, that's the human self declaring its dignity, not its absurdity, not despairing. Well,
No, the absurdity is not in the response. The absurdity is in the effort being made by this government, by this regime, to do what it's been doing. And it's living through that experience. See, this is the difference, I believe, between, say, a Kant on the one hand, a philosopher, and a Camus, or a tragic poet on the other hand. I think, for example, of Martha Nussbaum and her claim that when it comes to Kant or Aristotle, it's not as if they are speaking to when we read them, we don't see ourselves in the situations or in the words that they offer us. It's not as if our lives are the puzzles that they present, be it Kant or Aristotle, and that the only thing that's missing is one piece and suddenly the puzzle will be resolved. It's something far more complicated. It's something that, as Camus tells us, we have to live through, we have to experience in order to understand the absurdity of it. I'm sorry, go ahead, Ken.
No, with regard to the political absurdity and rebellion, I mean, I'm a bit of a dilettante when it comes to Camus, but as I remember, like in Thought in the Meridian, he's a very unusual rebel. It's the act of rebellion that has all the meaning. He's not in favor of murdering anyone. He doesn't have any, I mean, Sartre was a Marxist, but Camus doesn't seem to think that any political system is going to be that much better than any other. Isn't the whole point the act of rebellion, not the result of rebellion, which is usually just one more god-awful system of government?
No, you're spot on there, John. Camus was, he had a tragic sense of life, and he knew that whatever system replaces the unjust one that now exists will sooner or later either become no less unjust or sort of degrade into a kind of mediocrity. He was fully aware of that. When it came to politics, though Sartre, like George Orwell, was very much on the left, he was a particular kind of left. He was really an anarchist. He was very close to syndicalist circles in France during his lifetime. He wrote for them pro bono in their obscure, barely known journals. And a bit like Jean-Pierre Proudhon, the ideal society for Camus was one of worker cooperatives with no overarching government.
Well, speaking of worker cooperatives, we've got an email from John in Berkeley.
The land of worker co-ops.
The land of something. You know, I'm teaching this semester in Berkeley, but I'm almost certain this isn't me, this John in Berkeley. Was Camus against having hope in the deep Kantian sense, as in, what can we hope? Or the Jesse Jackson political slogan sense of keep hope alive? But also in the ordinary way, we might hope that Aunt Bessie has a good flight home?
This is a good question. It's related to the question I asked at the end of the first segment, Rob.
What do you
I
want?
Think. That is, could the world be... I mean, okay, sure, that we're alienated from the world we occupy, maybe. And there's an absurdity in the relationship between us because our aspirations. But could there be a world? I mean, hope is the possibility of a world that actually does answer to our aspirations. I want Aunt Betty to get home safely. She can get home safely. My hope is satisfied. I want there to be justice for all. There could be justice for all. My hope is, my desire is satisfied. I mean, is it like the world is bound to disappoint our hopes or what? And why does he think it's bound to disappoint our hopes if he thinks that?
Well, first on the issue of hope and to address the question asked by the emailer, there is no hope, according to Camus, but as he goes on to say, that's not a reason for despair. We continue the struggle. We continue to maintain our dignity. We continue to insist upon our integrity. We continue to insist upon those fundamental qualities that we share with other human beings.
But,
now,
but Rob, to what end? Yes. To what end? We continue to insist, but with the hope that we might remake the world to match our deepest aspirations, but
no, not at all. That's what a revolutionary does, according to Camus. Ken, that's not what a rebel does. A rebel is most deeply a rebel is a moderate. A rebel is somebody who's aware that it's an act of really of equipoise or self-restraint, because a rebel is aware that at any moment her act of rebellion can spill over into revolution. And Camus was all too aware of the consequences of revolution in the 20th century. And it's something that he really does want to avoid. So it's not so much a question of making the world a better place, though, of course, as a political activist, that's something that Camus does not lose sight of. But at a deeper level, it's simply a question of resisting, of maintaining a kind of balance between the way the world is and the way the world ought to be.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Camus with our guest, Robert Zaretsky from the University of Houston.
So Rob, I mean, I like the idea of the rebel, of resistance, of refusing what the world foists upon us, but there's many forms that might take. And my sense mm-hmm. is that Camus would approve of some more than others. I mean, the people out in Moscow, I think he would approve of that. The person who says, screw the world, I'm going to be selfish and just make as much money as I can. He might not approve of that so much. What's the difference?
Well, wait a minute. Now, maybe you're right about Camus, but Simone de Beauvoir at the Ethics of Ambiguity kind of implicitly criticizes what seems to be Camus' view, that Camus' existentialist hero is what she calls a mere adventurer who only cares about his own self-declaration, his own projects, and is indifferent to the outcome of those projects, is indifferent to who he tramples. So she seems to think that Camus' formula is itself going to lead to a kind of tyranny. I bet you think that's an unfair criticism of Camus. Rob.
Well, it's unfair, Ken, because it is, in a sense, ahistorical. De Beauvoir, in The Ethics of Ambiguity, is mostly focused on the stranger and the myth of Sisyphus. In other words, two of the three works that constitute what Camus called his cycle of absurdity, of right. the absurd. But Camus moves on from that. By 1942, in the midst of France's occupation by Nazi Germany, he writes in his journal, "The absurd teaches nothing." He realized that he had to move beyond the figure of Sisyphus, that it simply didn't serve as an inspiration or as a guide for what to do in France, in occupied France at that moment. And what I found interesting is that in the the presentation at the beginning of the program, much was said about Camus being in Paris and hobnobbing with the intellectuals on the left bank, but nothing was said about the most formative period of his life in occupied France, the period he spent in Chambon-sur-Lignon in southeastern France. Chambon was a town, a Protestant village that over the course of the war hid and saved the lives of about 2,000 to 3,000 Jewish children. And Camus, as a cure for his tuberculosis, was living in a farmhouse just outside of the village, and he was surely aware of what was taking place. But, and much of what took place actually spills into his novel, The Plague, which was published in 1947. I'm sorry.
I love The Plague, and I love the point you're making, but still, you might say, well, Camus had a philosophy, and he had a life, and we admire him for his life, we admire him for his instincts. But does his philosophy really explain why we admire him more than, say, Heidegger, whose response to Nazism was much different, or to the slug who just went to the bar in that same town and said, too bad for all those miserable people, give me another drink?
I don't know. Think about Heidegger. In a way, his thought and his life do mesh. Unfortunately, that you can read his thought as an apology for Nazism. Certainly several philosophers far more qualified than I have seen it in just that light. Now we can say the same thing about Camus, that his thought and his life mesh. They're seamless. And yet we admire him in ways that we despise Heidegger for that same seamlessness of thought and life.
I think that's possibly right, but I think there's an intellectual gap between the quasi-existentialist theorizing and the life he lived. And I think that's what John is getting at. I think that's a really important gap. But, you know, we'll take that up some more after the break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Albert Camus with Robert Zaritsky from the University of Houston.
If life is truly absurd, what's the answer? Can there be any point to living? Or should we just all end it all?
How to live with the absurdity of life when Philosophy Talk continues.
Tuesday and Wednesday, nothing. Thursday for a change, a little more nothing. Friday once more nothing.
That's the Fugs, the great rock group, the precursors of punk rock. Can't understand why that isn't an all-time hit single. The Fugs and nothing, a whole lot of nothing. Pretty absurd. I'm sure Camus would have loved that song. Actually, I'm not sure of anything. But anyway, I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Robert Zaretsky, author of A Life Worth Living, Albert Camus, and The Quest for Meaning. Rob will be part of a live chat at our online community of thinkers on Friday, March 6th at 12 noon Pacific time. I hope you can join us at philosophytalk.org.
Rob Camus rejects religion, science, reason, and suicide as possible answers to the absurdity of life. So what's left? What is his solution to kind of continue what we're talking about at the end of the last segment?
Well, if we limit it to the myth of Sisyphus, what we're left with is the boulder. And of course, it's big. It's extremely difficult to push up the hill. And then time upon time, we have to trudge back down the hill in order to gather it and push it back up again. The reason why Camus wants us to imagine Sisyphus happy is because to the very end, Sisyphus remains defiant in the face or in the eyes of the gods who have condemned him to this punishment through all of time. In effect, what he does is that he makes the task his own. He claims ownership of that boulder, and by doing so, he remains his own person, or he reaffirms his dignity.
So I get that, and I guess I want to go back to the de Beauvoir kind of criticism of that early kind of thought of Camus. I'm not sure she was explicitly addressing Camus, but it seems to directly apply to Camus. That, you know, she worried that existentialism It had two problems. It was threatened with what she called a sterile solipsism, and on the one hand, and an empty formalism on the other hand. The sterile solipsism had to do with, it only matters what I make of my life. Whatever anybody else throws on me, I can throw it off. So what I make of my life is all that matters. There's no trans. I don't need to look to any universe to confirm or verify or validate what I do or desire. That's the pointless task. And the empty formalism, she said, well, the only thing that existentialism says to do is to be free. Do it freely. And do what freely? Kill freely? Rob freely? So she really worried about whether existentialism could have an ethics, could have a morality. And I think she thought that Camus' kind of thought had no answer to either of these things. But you seem to suggest that he came to see that himself, and that later on he developed some kind of plausible thought about these two worries that some existentialists had about existentialism itself, right? That it couldn't really direct us how to live our lives and how to relate to others.
He does offer something of an answer. He does move on from that first cycle to the second cycle, which he called the cycle of rebellion. But the answers he offers, Ken, in that second cycle are provisional. I do think they respond to de Beauvoir's critique. I should say that, of course, the true solipsist was not Camus. It was Simone de Beauvoir, remarkably so.
You mean psychologically?
Psychologically. Yeah. I mean, there's just no comparison between the two. But that's neither here nor there. But Camus understood from the very beginning, in fact, in 1938, when he was working for a small newspaper in Algiers, and he reviewed Sartre's Nausea and then his collection of short stories under the title The Wall. He admired Sartre tremendously, but he also worried about Sartre's take on human existence. He thought that for Sartre, at least in these stories, life is tragic because it's wretched. And that's simply not the case. For Camus, it was always the case that life is tragic because it is magnificent, it's glorious. He loved the world, the physical world, in ways that Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre could never begin to plumb.
Now, I'm not a big scholar of these folks, but I think of them as having these deeply intertwined intellects and lives and personal relationship and all this sort of stuff. Now, I gather that their falling out wasn't really about that actress, but it was about a review that Camus wrote of Sartre that incensed Sartre, and it had something to do with freedom or something like that.
It's more complex. What happened in 1952, following the publication of The Rebel, Camus was waiting for the most important literary and political magazine of his time, Les Temps Modernes, Modern Times, to run a review of it. And this was the journal that was edited by Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. And weeks, months passed, there was nothing. And then finally, there was a review, not by Sartre, but by one of his staff members, Francis Janson. And the review was appalling, not just from an intellectual perspective, but also from a personal. It was largely ad hominem, attacking Camus the man and not just Camus the thinker. And Camus wrote back to, not to Janson and not to the journal, but to Sartre, in which he took Sartre to task for allowing this review to appear in print in the pages of this journal. And that's when Sartre responded by one of the most extraordinarily violent, but at times very telling, responses to Camus' work as well as Camus the man.
Were these guys just childish intellectuals?
Well, I suspect if the actress wasn't at the bottom of it all, she added a little icing on the cake
or
whatever.
But John, you're onto something very important there, because I think I don't want to psychologize these men. I'm in no position to do it. But as your reporter mentioned, Sartre was not a terribly attractive man, and he always envied Camus' ability. I mean, just his ease, not just the fact that he was handsome, but that he was a terrific dancer, that he was you know, he was a wonderful comic. The way he would mimic the voices of people from Algeria, from Algiers. But he also envied the fact that Camus was not like him, a member of the Parisian bourgeoisie. Oh. Camus was from the working class. His background was an impoverished one. And in a way, Sartre, de Beauvoir, I mean, that entire circle of left-wing intellectuals on the left bank envied Camus for being the real thing.
Rob, that's really intriguing, and I had no idea that was true. But I want to get back to the theoretical issues as we draw to a close. My sense in the little bit of reading I've done for the show, my memories about my existentialist years, it seems to me that Camus, let me put it this way. Camus, although he didn't like to be called a philosopher, he read a lot of philosophy. He quotes Heidegger, he quotes Jaspers, he quotes all kinds of people, but I don't ever remember a quote from Hume. I think he would have been better off spending some time with Hume, because it sounds like, from what you describe as his years in southern France, that he had that natural sympathy for others. That, you know, the spark that we would now trace to evolution, and for Hume was just a wonderful mystery. That I would think is what gives meaning. You know, how can you raise children or feed children or deal with hungry children and not have some sense that what you're doing matters? So it sounds like he was able to close the circle between Sisyphus and meaning in his life, but he never figured out theoretically how to do it.
Well, you know, it's interesting, the comparison with David Hume, John. I like that a lot. I think they do have I don't think Camus ever read Hume, but I do think they have a great deal in common, beginning with their skepticism. And also this notion that we have this capacity for compassion. It's just part of our being. Now, I don't think he closes it theoretically, Camus. Namely, he doesn't close the circle. But I do think he closes it in terms of narrative. And again, we see it in The Rebel, and we see it in The Plague. He is working towards this. He understands that this experience of being in the same situation, either under an oppressive regime or under an oppressive cosmos, brings us together and brings out the best in us. Nothing is clearer as a moral or as a lesson than that in his novel, The Plague. But again, don't look to him for a theoretical closing of the circle. He's not a theoretician. He's a novelist. He's a storyteller. And that's where he's attempting to do it.
So we've got some email that kind of follows up on what we've been talking about. Can you ask the guest to say something about Camus' Algerian background and the influence it had on his philosophical thinking? You've told us about the influence it had on the Parisian people who kind of admired his richer life. But what... Yeah. Tell us a little more about his Algerian upbringing.
Be brief. I know you could tell us a lot, but tell us just the highlights. Right.
Well, then, actually, rather than telling you about his Algerian background, let me tell you about something specific to his Algerian background, namely his relationship with his mother. Mm. His mother, Catherine Sintès, was a typical Algerian. In other words, she was an immigrant. She came from the island of Mallorca. Catherine Sintès was illiterate. She was partly deaf and mostly mute. She had a vocabulary of a few hundred words. And one of the most important influences on Camus' life was living in the world of silence created by his mother. His entire life he spent trying to make sense of that silence and of his relationship to his mother. I should mention that his grandmother, who also raised him, was illiterate as well. And so here's Camus. In a way, struggling to find meaning in this universe that is constituted by his mother. Now, we can speak more broadly about his Algerian experience that I think added to his sense of the absurd when you think about the fact that he lived in a nation where 9/10 of its inhabitants were denied the rights and the privileges of French citizenship. Something that he was acutely aware of and protested his entire life.
You know, Rob, this Camus sounds like a really, not just, he's not, I've been familiar with his thought. He's a fascinating thinker. He sounds like a fascinating man, and the combination of the man and the thought is even more fascinating. And I got to tell you, this has been an absurdly fun conversation, but I got to end it, and thank you for joining us.
Well, listen, thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
OK, Okay, our guest has been Robert Zaretsky. He's a professor of history at the Honors College at the University of Houston. He's author of A Life Worth Living, Albert Camus and the Quest for Meaning. And he's also author of the forthcoming Boswell's Enlightenment. So, John, you got any absurdist thoughts to leave us with?
Well, not too many absurdist thoughts. I mean, I was really fascinated to learn something I hadn't known, the jealousy or envy that the French, the Parisian thinkers had for Camus, as opposed to, you know, just thinking. I mean, there's a little analogy with Hume there, too. Hume came from the from Scotland, and so did Boswell, who's the subject of our guest's newest book. And they had a lot of trouble getting accepted, partly because of their Scottish burr, even from the Highlands in London. So that's fascinating.
You know, if you look at a picture, there's a picture of Camus on Rob's book. He really was quite a handsome guy. I mean, he and Jean-Paul Sartre look like some kind of gnome. So, you know, there's more to philosophy than meets the eye sometimes. Yes,
than doesn't meet the eye.
Yeah, right. But again, I really think he's a fascinating guy. I really recommend Rob's book. It's a great read. But, you know, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org. And please join us at the community on Friday, March 6th at 12 noon Pacific for a live online chat with today's guest, Robert Zaretsky.
And now, a man of absurdly fast speech, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second existentialist.
Ian Scholes, the absurd doesn't have the panache it did back in the 1960s, but then again, Camus doesn't have the panache he once did. We don't follow the myth of Sisyphus rolling a boulder uphill all day, only to have it roll down again at night. Today, thanks to the great thinker Ayn Rand, we believe we can get that rock up the hill and keep it there once we get big government off our backs. In France, where meaninglessness first reared its ugly head, people had gone through two world wars, and things were pretty torn up and depressing. In America, though, we were complacent and well off, something for young people to rebel against. It's entitled American Exceptionalism, Existentialism. If life is absurd, who needs a job? Let's invent album-oriented rock. Let's get stoned and have sex. Which is pretty much what young Camus and Sartre wanted, near as I could tell, also to create a more perfect world using only their words. Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre became friends in Paris during World War II. He got Sartre to go to New York to write about it for his underground resistance publication called Combat, or Combat. Sartre viewed New York as too big and anonymous. He also thought that Americans created their own prisons of conformity. He thought of skyscrapers as ancient ruins ripe to be torn down. Camus, on the other hand, who went to New York in 1946, loved it. Didn't pay much attention to skyscrapers, liked taking taxis, Broadway, ice cream, shopping. He also had sex with young women, so had Sartre when he was there, but he was not as fun-loving. He complained to his French lover, Simone de Beauvoir, "I am killed by passion and lectures," which is creepy on several levels. What did young Camus get from Sartre? Well, thanks to existentialism, the personal meets the historical. You don't know how history will work out, but you can act like you do. He's like a really depressing motivational speaker. You can be whatever you want to be, and then die, in the mud, alone. But in 1951, they had a falling out. Sartre believed that a writer should be an engaged revolutionary. You might not get the rock up the hill, but history will, so kill anybody that gets in the way. Camus wrote Mad en Revolt, which argued against the idea of mass murder for noble ideas. In his literary magazine, Sartre had a subordinate review the book, and it was nasty. Camus got mad and wrote Sartre directly, blaming him for his reviewer's opinions. Sartre wrote back, hinting that Camus' thinking was muddled and banal. Upshot, the two never spoke again. Camus died in 1960 at 46 in a car crash. Sartre died in 1980. The bloom had pretty much come off his rose. His consistent non-judgmentalism towards the many crimes of the Soviet Union rankled many. And others were rankled when he chose to visit members of the Baader-Meinhof gang in prison. Remember who they were? No? Oh, good. There's one stone. You don't have to roll uphill anymore. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Thanks also to Ted Muldoon, Merle Kessler, Erica Topit, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Yeah, I think we really got something in.
What do we got?
An idea.
What idea?
An idea for the show.
I still don't know what the idea is.
It's about nothing.